Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. I suppose I should say welcome back to Reimagining Liberty. It's been a hot minute since the last episode, so let me start by telling you what's been going on, because it actually tees up today's conversation. The short version is, I've been neck deep in getting a very cool new project ready for launch called liberalism.org. It is an online magazine of liberal ideas, which I'm leading in collaboration with my colleagues at the Institute for Humane Studies. Depending on when you're listening to this, it might already have launched, because it's scheduled to go live on March 12th. Regardless, you can get on the mailing list by heading to liberalism.org. As part of this project, I'm hosting a new bi-weekly podcast called The Liberalism.org Show. It'll be half-hour interviews with contributors to the site, which means interviews with some of the most interesting minds in liberalism today. You can look for that wherever you get your podcasts. All of this just swamped me, and I had to take a step back from reimagining liberty. I'm glad you stuck around through this hiatus. And to bring us back, I'm actually joined today by one of those colleagues on liberalism.org, Jason Cannon. He's director of public scholarship at the Institute for Humane Studies, and for at least the last year, he and I have been talking nonstop about a shared intellectual project about what it means to think of liberalism as a practice or a set of practices. You've heard me discuss versions of this in quite a lot of prior episodes, but today I wanted to bring Jason on for a deep dive and to establish a foundation for future conversations. We talk about what it means to view something as a practice, how practice theory plugs holes in liberal theorizing, why this approach is largely overlooked by contemporary philosophers of liberalism, and what that oversight means missing out on. I loved this conversation with Jason. Reimagining Liberty is, as always, a listener-supported show. If you value these conversations and want to listen to them a week early, you can become a patron. Head over to patreon.com/AaronRossPowell to learn more, or look for a link in the show notes. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Jason. What is a practice?
Practice is any customary activity that we take part in. So Ted Shotsky, who's one of the leading practice theorists in sociology, says that practices are doings and sayings. And that sounds like a pretty granular way of understanding the social experience, social life. And it is, but things get built by the addition in combination of social practices. So you get nexuses and bundles and ensembles of practices that come together, and they form the kinds of institutions and settings that we're just so familiar with in everyday life. So standing in a line is a kind of practice. There's a way that you stand in a line, and if you mess that up, people will let you know. This is front of mind for me because it's a national pastime in England. They have a way of queuing that is vitally important, not just to the social order of Britain, but to the identity of what it means to be British. And so that's just one example of the kinds of things that we do so often that we don't even really recognize as being a practice, being a thing that we do regularly, routinely with others. But once you start looking at things at that level of analysis, A, you start to see practices everywhere, and B, it gives you a different lens on social life that I find really productive.
Can you maybe give some more examples? Because what you just described, so getting a line or queuing across the pond, sounds just like a social norm. You eat with this fork, or put your napkin on your lap. But to practice feels bigger than just social norms or manners.
So the norm part in social norm, I think, is building in a normative element by definition, that is true of practice, but the practice is the activity beyond the norm itself. So just to say that differently, we're absolutely talking about the same sphere of activities, and the way that our behavior gets shaped by society and the ways that we move through the world gets conditioned by norms, values, traditions, all sorts of things. But what practice theories will focus on, and I should stress that this is all very new for me. So this is, you know, the grad student who has been exposed to this stuff for just a couple months at this point. Practice focuses on the actual behavior itself and then wants to ask, well, what are the social structures, the social pressures that condition that practice? Some of those are going to be moral norms. Some of them are going to be cultural norms. A lot of them are going to be things that we can't put our fingers on, but we just know is the right way to do those things. This conversation is built up of a whole lot of practices. You're not talking over me. I'm not talking over you. I'm not shouting. We're talking in a sort of podcastery way. All of these things are practices of different kinds. And norms are one of the sort of side constraints that shapes that, but there are tons of other things as well.
What does this have to do with politics then? Or I suppose, why isn't this more present in political talk? So one of the things, like, you know, for listeners, like, you and I have been talking about this stuff for quite some time, and somehow kind of our independent, like, intellectual projects seem to have, like, converged on this, but from different directions that I think are really interesting. But one part of it is, like, talking about politics as something you do and what it means to do politics, but I'm using that term very broadly, but to, like, participate in politics, to be a liberal citizen, to be a member of a liberal society, a liberal polity, to engage in the activities that are conducive to that, that reinforce that, seems like a really obvious thing to spend a huge amount of attention on. If you care about liberalism, you care about preserving it, you care about expanding it, you care about engaging in it with others. And yet, most of the time, if you talk to people who, like, think about liberalism as an intellectual project, they will talk about, like, the rules governing institutions in the abstract, or the rules that exist in the Constitution, or the large books of statutes or regulations, but, like, these like principles that are applied. Then they talk about philosophical principles and moral rules. And then it's just kind of assumed, like, I believe this set of principles, therefore, like, I follow through on liberalism. But that following through and what that following through looks like in practice, what it means to do liberalism is often, like, ignored, certainly under theorized. And just to, like, kind of give the weight of, I think, this question, liberal practice, what it means to do liberalism actually in the world for each of us, which might vary for, you know, like, if you're a member of Congress, what it means to do liberalism in practice looks different than if you're, like, an ordinary voter, or have some other role in the broader liberal society. But given looking at the state of kind of our illiberal world right now, this seems like a really critical question of, like, what does it mean to do this so that we can, like, actually do it, as opposed to what's being done now? Why aren't we talking more about this stuff?
It's a great question. So let's come back to liberal practice in just a minute. Let's talk about political practice as a focus for social inquiry first. So just to put some numbers on this, which is not something that I ever really do as a political theorist, I gave the most recent APSA program from last year to three of the frontier AI models.
APSA is the American Political Science Association.
Yeah, right. The big political science conference. And I said, take this program and identify all of the things that could possibly go under the category of practice, the sorts of things that we might engage in. Virtue and character is one way that this has historically gotten cashed out. Those are sets of practices. The kinds of practices that involve going to, you know, Rotary Club meetings and that sort of thing. Didn't need to use the word practice, but anything that might, any sort of routine activity that does things for us politically. Look for examples of that in the paper titles and abstract. And the results were that of the 6,000 some odd papers at APSA last year, about 2% were even in the neighborhood. And nearly all of those didn't use practice as a lens. And that's really shocking to me. It's shocking for a few reasons. One, in sociology, practice theory has become an important way that the discipline understands its activities and has become a really important part of interpretive sociology. Some of the biggest figures, Giddens, Bourdieu, these folks are central to what modern sociology is, and practice was central to their work. For some reason, that has not filtered into political science that much, with the exception of international relations. And it certainly hasn't moved into political theory or political philosophy. I think that's because political theorists have been talking about similar things with different language for a long time. So ethos, for example, is a very trendy thing in political theory right now. There's lots of dissertations and books being written about what a certain kind of ethos means for a liberal democracy. Virtue, character, as I mentioned, these are explicitly discussed in practice terms. And this, I think, is a really important thing to note. It wasn't always this way. So the fact that we don't spend much time talking about practice as a political phenomenon is a remarkably new fact about social inquiry. So when you go back through the history of political philosophy, nearly all of the greatest minds up through the Enlightenment and for most of the Enlightenment are talking about things in practice terms. They're talking about mores. Tocqueville spent so much time unpacking what he calls the habits of the heart in America. Aristotle thinks that practice and habit is central not only to ethics, but the connection between ethics and politics, and on down the line. So there's a really deep tradition of people using practice to understand the bi-directional relationship that we have with our institutions. Institutions shaping us, us shaping our institutions. And for whatever reason, that intellectual toolkit has been set aside. I have some very ill-formed theories about why that might be. I think one of them is that for whatever reason, character and virtue is just entirely right-coded these days. It seems like it's the domain of conservatives. And in fact, if I'm being really honest, I was put off for a long time by really engaging with Tocqueville because the only people who were talking about him were like conservatives or conservative leaning. And it turns out he's, of course, brilliant and has a lot of important things to say. But I think it's really telling that that kind of concern has been shunted to one side of the ideological spectrum. And I think that creates a lot of negative polarization where others just aren't engaging with questions of virtue because it feels like it's the kind of thing that their political enemies are more concerned about.
I think there's also, and this is, I should say, this is kind of inchoate thoughts in my head right now, but I have this general sense that even the revival of virtue ethics is relatively recent and kind of came from like outsiders A lot of it came from like women entering the academy and reviving Aristotle. And there still is a view among non-virtue ethics scholars, say in philosophy, that it's like, it's too fuzzy. It's not like the right way of really thinking like philosophically. And what I think about is that it feels like there's this distinction, and this ties into like the way that liberalism gets talked about. And I think what kind of liberal practice theory would push back on between what I guess I'll call like argumentation and illumination. And the purpose of philosophical thinking, theoretical thinking, on the one hand, is about argumentation, drawing lines, giving a precise definition, defending that definition against counter definitions, getting narrower and narrower and narrower until you have like an insurmountably argued for position. And there's a lot of value in that, and it can help us get clarity on important questions. But it also cuts against philosophy as illumination, as like, I read this and wow, this gives me like a really important way to think about things or experience things or adjust my perspective on things. And as you said, like there used to be more illumination. Like you read, you know, like the Nicomachean Ethics, and it's like, here's this kind of perspective for viewing the world. And there's an argumentative project in there, but it's really like building a way of seeing. Continental philosophy still does a lot more, I think, of the illumination stuff and less of the argumentation approach. But if we are thinking about it in terms of practice, practice is more of, it's something you do, Jason. It's something I do. It's an experience you have. It's more phenomenological than it is like following a flowchart of deontology or doing the math of utilitarianism. It's fuzzier. And the way that you would counsel people in a practice necessarily is fuzzier. Like if you pick up a book on how to play the guitar, it's not an argument. You know, it's not presented as like, well, here's an argument about against other ways you might play the guitar. And like, it's kind of trying to like give you a sense of the experience. These are the things you will experience. This is how to process them. This is how to understand them. This is how to develop, cultivate them, and so on. And so I think part of it is that like thinking about liberalism as a practice is just a very different mode of thinking. It necessarily, if you want it to be normative, if you want it to actually like affect the world, which is what practices are, they're like you participating in things that have an effect on the world, you need to be thinking more in that illumination mode than strictly the argumentation mode. And so it's somewhat foreign.
Let's also add a third category to your distinction here, which is modes of living. So there's a way to run argumentation and illumination where it's just all about information, knowledge, beliefs, right? That in a lot of communities and in a lot of settings looks like orthodoxy. There's a right set of things to know, to hold as true, and to build your life around. The things that I think are really interesting for you and me, not just in broadly liberal society, but also in Buddhism and elsewhere, is not orthodoxy, but orthopraxy, which has been a concept that I've really enjoyed playing with over the past few months. And there the view is not that we need to have the correct set of beliefs and that that requires all kinds of logic chopping and the sorts of things that you are pointing to with in analytic philosophy, but that there is a way to live well, a certain kind of right action. And how do you get that right action? Well, it's not that you memorize a whole bunch of scriptures or that you consult the right guru and they deliver the truth in some way. No, it's that you go through all of these practices that are laid out in these wisdom traditions So, you know, in Buddhism, this is the Eightfold Path. And it's the very act of engaging in the practice that helps you figure out what right action means. You have to start with some sense of what's true, what's valuable. You have to do some sort of learning. This is where meditation and other practices come in. It is about illumination in some real sense. But the end goal is acting in a way that promotes some sort of choice-worthy end. And I find that to be a really useful way to think not just about philosophy in the way that Addo talks about this in Philosophy as a Way of Life, but just as a way of sort of orienting my life, what it means to be a flourishing, integrated person. It means to be setting aside worse practices that I find so seductive and that I slip into so frequently in place of practices that promote those sort of ends. And let me just say one more thing, because I think you're pointing to something that's really important in this conversation. That's hard. Orthodoxy is easy in the sense that it's very comforting to feel that you have been delivered on a silver platter the truth. And that all you need to do in your life to discover purpose or to live well is to match your beliefs to this sacred understanding of whatever. And that sacred understanding can be scripture. It can be forms of politics. It can be identities and relationships to subcultures. It could be a whole lot of things. But we love the idea that all we need is the right book or the right syllogism or the right regression to get clear knowledge of the world and how everything fits together. And the truth is, as you're pointing to, that things are just fuzzy and the world doesn't have those neat edges. And we have to be really comfortable. And this is itself a practice. We have to become really comfortable with living and working through the muddiness of it all. And I think that that's true in figuring out what we want our lives to look like. It's true in the way that we approach social science. It's true in how we approach philosophy. The more that we can get comfortable thinking about our own lives as these sets of activities that can be to some degree chosen, but chosen within a constrained set, but developed, cultivated, reflected on, improved, set aside, I think the happier we will be, and also the smarter we will be, or at least the better way to put it is probably the clearer view of the world that we will gain.
Pulling this into the context of liberalism, one thing that I have noticed over the last however many years is we've witnessed the illiberal turn in American politics and in politics elsewhere in the world, is people who have the orthodoxy of liberalism figuring out ways to be illiberal or to get on board with illiberalism. And I think one of the problems with the orthodoxy approach of being like, I just have this book of principles, is a book of principles is a statement of terms in language. And here I'll put on like my old school postmodernist, post-structuralist hat. That's always to some degree or another underdetermined, right? There's always an interpretive element to it. The principles alone cannot, first, they're not self-enforcing. And second, they cannot apply to every situation. And you could try to solve that by just adding endless epicycles of sub-principles for every conceivable situation you might encounter. But you're still going to run into new ones because the world is constantly novel, And so what you need is a way of dealing with novel situations and a way of correcting against the, like, the urge to consciously or unconsciously, authentically or cynically, interpret and reinterpret the principles in ways that kind of get you what you want, even if that runs against the spirit of the principles. And this is where I think there's the argumentation, but there's the illumination mode. Like, illumination simply means like shining a light on something. And what that means is that you are now seeing something you didn't see before. And this has been my hobby horse for quite a while, is that so much of ethical behavior, and that includes ethical politics, is not just having like an intellectual cognitive understanding of a set of principles, but it is noticing. It's seeing that this behavior I'm engaging in or this thing I have voted for is hurting these people. And so you might vote for it in line with like the principles you have, or support this politician in line with the principles you have. You're not saying, I want to support this because it will hurt these people, but rather you're just not even noticing that it is. And so you can kind of convince yourself you're still operating in the realm of your principles, but it's because your ethical perspective is not complete enough to notice where you're violating those principles in spirit. And so what we need is a perspective of noticing more than we often do, expanding kind of the realm of moral concern. This is what liberalism, like the liberal project, has, one way to frame it has been an expansion of the realm of moral concern to what were formerly like our prior out-groups, and saying, no, they matter just as much as my in-group does. Like that's a core view of liberalism. But it's not just the conceptual, like, oh, the arguments for why I should exclude those people from the realm of moral concern don't hold up to scrutiny, but also this perspective of like noticing that those people are still functionally falling outside of the realm of moral concern. But doing that is necessarily as like a habit, it's a practice. I can argue to you, you should actually be paying attention to this thing. But then when our conversation ends, your habits of mind and noticing and perception experience just go back to what they were. It takes work to expand. It takes, you have to say, oh, actually, wait, like I should pay attention to that. I stopped paying attention to that. I mean, Buddhist kind of like, this is the paying attention to your experience. It's very easy to like just lose track of it, like bring it back. It's developing those habits, those practices, those like ways of doing things, not just like cognitively understanding things. And this sounds very like, this sounds very abstract and can sound very wishy-washy, but I really think this is like key, is that a habit is not, it's not simply like physical acts, but it's like habits of, or a practice. It's practices of mind. It's practices of perception, of noticing. And so what we need to be doing is liberalism as a set of practices, as a thing that we do, has to have this component of like, what are the things that you should be noticing? What are the things you should be paying attention to? How do you cut against all the incentives to like cramp your moral perspective, to push people outside of the realm of what you notice as morally salient in a liberal context. But that has to come through practice. It has to be something you like repeatedly do and kind of rewire yourself for.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. One word that we might use to describe what you're pointing to is discernment. And the handy thing about orthodoxy is that it really doesn't require that much discernment. If you have the set of rules, if you know the categorical imperative, you can work out algorithmically what it is that you're supposed to do. But the problem, and this is again something that you're pointing to, is that orthodoxy also encourages you to find loopholes, right? You have rules. But the rules don't apply to every situation. And so necessarily, there will be cases where we have to apply judgment, where we do need discernment. And if you're not used to exercising discernment and being very careful about noticing, then it's very easy to just kind of go with what feels good for you, right? And I say this as a ex-evangelical former fundamentalist who was born and raised with a set of values that were complete when I was born and handed to me and told, and you know, and I was told, this is what we believe. We would sing a song called the Doxology virtually every Sunday. I mean, the concept of doxa and orthodoxy was just permeated throughout the tradition. And how many times as a teenager who had the set of beliefs that he held to be true, but also had all of these emotions and hormones and desires and all these other things, how often did I find it very easy to stretch the boundaries of what those rules required, right? The place that I have come to as I've gotten older is a view that also has a very rich history. It's the view of the sentimentalists. This was actually our last podcast conversation. And here the idea is that in some ways, morality is also a socially emergent phenomenon. So the things that we hold to be right and good are things that we read off of our social relationships and the effects that these have in society. And whatever the merits of that view as an understanding of ethics, it requires a hell of a lot of discernment. And so this is why you have people like Adam Smith talking about things like the impartial spectator, which can be a kind of practice. In fact, at several points, Smith talks about engaging in sympathetic understanding in this kind of way. Why? Because it's formative. The act of thinking about and imagining myself to be you, and you then imagining yourself to be me, and us doing this sort of back and forth exercise of sympathetically engaging with one another and trying to inhabit others' perspectives, that's something that deeply shapes our morality, the core of who we are. And so if that's right, the sentimentalists want to suggest, the way through all of the murkiness of morality is not to hope that somebody is going to give us the right doctrine, because that's going to have all kinds of bad effects, and it's just not going to be true in the end. It's going to be something that can't be defended. But it's to develop the kinds of mental faculties that allow for us to exercise discernment when we need to. And almost always, that's going to lead us away from harming others and toward promoting our shared ends.
What does it look like, to the degree that we can get concrete right now, what does it look like to think about liberalism in these terms? Because we obviously still need the rules and principles part of it. It's not about throwing that out. Like, there needs, we have governing institutions, they have to be bound by certain sets of rules that are conducive to liberalism, support a liberal society, enable the elements of a liberal society. We need laws and regulations of some form that are built along liberal lines. Moral talk needs to have principles, even if they don't apply, like even if you have to use discernment to apply them or notice where they apply in different situations, we still need to talk about these kinds of ideas. So this isn't about getting rid of like the history of moral theorizing or of liberal theorizing. It's about supplementing it with these extra concerns and understanding. What does that look like? Someone who's listening to this and is like, okay, you're telling me that I need to be like thinking about what I'm doing, but what does that mean, Jason?
So for me, what this means is shifting our gaze from these big abstract concepts toward the practices that we understand intimately well. So what is capitalism? Well, if you ask somebody who is sort of a market liberal type, they'll say capitalism is this set of rules and institutions that allows for us to explore our deepest productive meanings, and it allows for us to exchange in ways that promote our flourishing ends, that sort of thing. But we don't mean by that crony capitalism, and we don't mean by that a whole bunch of negative effects that capitalism has on the environment and externalities and that sort of thing. We don't mean that by capitalism. And then if you ask a socialist what they mean by capitalism, they'll say a lot of the same things in terms of individual exchange, but also we do mean by capitalism exactly the kind of cronyism and environmental degradation and everything else that the market liberal has just tried to define away. The problem with working entirely at that level of analysis is that these concepts are so polyvalent, meaning that they have so many different meanings to so many different people, and they contain so much that it's really hard for us to get beyond the definitional work of what we mean by the thing to actually start talking about where we can go as people and as societies in terms of making our lives better, creating more emancipatory institutions, practices, that sort of thing. And so the major upshot that I see for bringing practice back into social thought is that it allows us to move away from that super high level abstraction of democracy and the rule of law and capitalism and liberalism and all the rest. We need those concepts. They do some important work. But what I'm much more interested in is asking, what are the practices, the actual activities that promote liberal ends? And once you start asking that question, well, then you start looking around and saying, well, I'm a part of a lot of these practices, or I can observe them in different parts of the world. And this seems like something that we should experiment with. So for example, just to give a very concrete case, several years ago, I went to the Nordic countries for a few weeks, just kind of traipsed around, talked to people about their politics, read some books, and ate a lot of fish because that's what they do. And when I came back, I wrote a little essay called Not Perfect, But Better, just sort of reflecting on these experiences. Because to my mind, the Nordics as a whole do the best job of any contemporary societies of managing freedom and equality. And that's not just a qualitative assessment on my part. Many of the rankings of freedom and happiness and so many of the things that you would care about put these countries at the very top. And the reaction when I came home from so many people was this: that's fine for the Swedes, but that would never work here. Well, what wouldn't work here? Well, the Nordic model, that wouldn't work here. Well, what do we mean by the Nordic model? Well, we mean a bunch of social norms and institutions and laws and ways of living that are directed toward some of these ends. Okay, well, if we keep digging down into what those things mean, we get into stuff that people actually have some sort of understanding of, right? We get to actual practices and legal codifications like parental leave. And it turns out that even when you talk to conservatives who think, oh, the Nordic model, isn't that socialism? When you start talking at the level of individual practice and you start talking about the way that Norway implements its parental leave policy, suddenly there's a heck of a lot more agreement and understanding than there was when you were operating at the level of the ideology or the social system. And that's because we all have some connection to parental leave. We are either parents or we know parents who have used this. We're all the children of parents who have grappled with some of these problems. And so now we're into the realm of things that we actually really understand and have some experience with. And so I think that that's a really productive move for all of us, but especially for liberals, because if it's true that what we care most about is creating a society of free equals, then the thing that we should be doing is not asking, well, again, what, back to the orthodoxy problem, what is the right way to understand liberalism? What is the true set of beliefs that a liberal must have? And then let's just roll that out as if it were a party platform. The best thing that we can do is start to look around for the practices that are actually liberating people, that are increasing their flourishing, and also the practices that are harming people and are dominating them, diminishing their well-being, pursue that former set, and then run away from the latter set as fast as we possibly can. That doesn't require grand theories of justice. It doesn't require understanding all social phenomena and how they cohere. It just asks us to look around the world and see what makes our lives better and do more of that and less of the other stuff.
And if you're right about this, it seems like it potentially addresses a real problem that liberalism has either had or is perceived to have. And that is the kind of detachment from the daily lived experience of people. That liberals talk at this like technocratic level or these high theories and structures and institutions levels. And one of the narratives about, well, how did we get into this illiberal moment is something like, look, liberalism might have worked in terms of macro measures, Freedom House rankings of, or GDP growth, but for so many people, they didn't feel it. They felt like things were getting worse for them. Economic dynamism meant that the industry that used to be the center of their town dried up or moved elsewhere and their town was hollowed out. Interconnectedness and social dynamism meant that their kids moved away to the cities and they don't feel the connections that they once had, or their kids abandoned the ways that they found meaning in their own lives. Rapid social change meant that they're less comfortable in the world. Like, there's all these things where we can say, look, we can tell you, we can show you, like, in the economic measures and the other measures, things are better, but it's like they don't feel it. And so then they turned to a strong man or an ideology, a perspective that said, like, I can fix all of that. And of course it can't. That's the real thing we're witnessing right now, is like people voted for a strong man because they thought it would take them back to the way things were when they felt happier and more content and whatever. But in fact, it's awful and everyone hates it, or most everyone hates it. And everything's getting worse. But the urge there is like understandable. And what you're saying in this perspective on these practices is these practices are things that actually make us feel better. That they're the practices in our lives that improve the quality of the lives. And the argument for liberalism within this, or an argument for liberalism, is that it turns out, at least this is my argument that I have made, it turns out that the practices in your daily life that in the aggregate prop up and expand liberalism as a political, economic, and social system also just on their own make your life better and happier, more contented, more peaceful. And so there's an argument for engaging in these practices, even if you don't care at all about the macro level stuff. Like it just doesn't, it's not on your mind. Cultivating these moral perspectives, cultivating these behaviors, these values are good for you. And then in the aggregate, they increase, strengthen liberalism, which then has the effect of making the world better for everyone else too. And so that answers the question of like, why should I hold to liberal principles if in my own life they're going to like, I could get ahead. That's one of the other things we're watching right now is a whole bunch of people running the federal government who are just in it for themselves. It's graft. It's corruption because they just don't care about anything other than just like, I want to line my pockets. I want to get ahead. I will screw over everyone. I will make things worse for large segments of the population because like I gain from it. And you could tell them stop on the principles ground, but they're like, why would I stop? This is pretty rad. But if you can argue instead, like, look, like embodying liberal perspectives and values, principles, norms in your own life makes your life better. And then it also has this knock-on effect that's a pretty great one of making the world better. And then further, that the illiberal alternatives don't do this. You know, this is my objection to like people still hanging out on Twitter, is that Twitter is like a platform in which you practice illiberal habits. You inculcate illiberal habits and perspectives. You train yourself to be a liberal, even if that's not your intention. And that makes your life worse. It makes you angrier. It makes you more hateful. It makes you feel separated from large swaths of humanity, resentful of large swaths of humanity. It makes your life worse. Illiberalism does that. It doesn't make people happier. It makes them unhappy, even if they don't recognize it immediately. Liberalism and these values has the opposite effect. So it seems like it solves that. Like, why should I care about like your vision of the world, Jason? Why should you want the world to be more liberal? Why should I care? It's like, well, because it's good for you. And if you try it and you practice, you'll see that it's good for you and you won't want to give it up.
So, as you know, I find that vision of the world really appealing. I would describe it in maybe a different way. So, as you look out at everything that happens in society, there are any number of different kinds of practices. So, there are protective practices that preserve a sphere of agency for individuals. That typically is what we think of with liberalism. There are participatory practices. This tends to be the kind of thing we talk about with democracy. But there are all kinds of other practices. There are contemplative practices, consumer practices, cultural practices, all kinds. I mean, when you look out at the way that a lot of, when you look out at the world in the way that some pretty radical practice theorists do, that's it. They have what they call a flat ontology, meaning it's just practices all the way down. I think there's something to that. Not quite sure just exactly how I feel about it, but it is a useful way to at least experiment with seeing the world. When you see the world in that way, you start to notice that there are some practices that integrate us, both within ourselves and within our communities, and a bunch of other practices that disintegrate us, that create disharmony between our actions and our beliefs and our emotions, our affects. And what you're pointing to, I think, is that we have really good reasons to be promoting integrative practices and calling out the ones that are actually dividing us internally and externally. So Adam Phillips said that the problem with Trump is that he brings out the Trump in all of us. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. Many problems with Trump, but that's certainly at the top. Like, however you describe this political moment, it makes us exhausted and fearful and angry, and it really brings out the worst in us. And so what we as liberals need to do is to, within ourselves, because this really is an ethical project, like it starts with us. We have to identify which of those practices help integrate us, integrate our own values, integrate our values with the institutions that govern us and that we partially constitute and help shape. And then we have to take a really careful and close examination of the kinds of things that pull us apart. Here's what doesn't work. It doesn't work to say, well, we're all getting richer, so don't worry. That's something that you will hear from a lot of market liberals, for example. That does nothing to address the kinds of concerns of the people who you've just been talking about, right? Nor does it really help that much, I think, for us to just say that those people need to go meditate, right? Factory left, like you have no prospects of living in your small town because of all sorts of other reasons. The best thing for you to do right now is just to, you know, go sit on the cushion. That may be a really important thing to take on, but in the moment when somebody is standing in the bread line, that's not the time for us to be talking about the advantages of metta practice, for example. It's a great time to exercise it, but like there are all kinds of other more pressing bodily needs that we need to meet. And so I think the challenge for liberals then is to say, one, broadly, abstracting from this moment, what are the kinds of practice conditions that we can create to allow us to lead really flourishing lives? And there, I think, it's going to be teaching our children about how their brain works, basic contemplative practices that don't require any sort of metaphysical or religious baggage, but helping them understand the basics of metacognition and what their thoughts are doing in their life. Like, that's the kind of thing that should be at the very foundation of an education system, but it's something that we completely ignore for the most part. So again, abstracting from this present moment, that's the kind of question that liberals should be asking. Which practices within the market are conducing to human flourishing? Which practices are actually constraining it and degrading it? We can work at that fine-grained level of analysis. And then in the moment, we have to exercise discernment to say, how can we remediate these harms as fast as possible, remove the sources of domination and injustice where those exist, and get to a place where these people feel like they are free and equal citizens again. And there's no reason why liberals can't work at all of these levels of analysis at the same time, but it requires a shift in thinking about how we should be devoting our attention and which problems we try to solve first.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.